Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to the Deceptively Fast Podcast. I am very excited about today's episode. Today is the first time that I think I genuinely got the format and the style of the podcast I want. And that includes our weekly visits with Sean Pendergast and Michael Lombardi, but also we'll start out with an interview with my old teammate, Owen Daniels. He's a two-time Pro Bowler. He is an all-rookie class of 2006 tight end. He won a Super Bowl. He won a high school state championship, and we talk about all of that. Plus, his training as a meteorologist just in college, and his son's battle with cancer. And it's some really, really good, deep stuff. And it's the kind of conversation that I had with teammates while I was playing, but I never got to have with a lot of these guys like Owen Daniels because he was a younger guy. I was an older guy, but really enjoyed my conversation with him. I'll put him up first, and then we have Sean Pendergast right at about the 1 hour mark, and then Michael Lombardi will be at 1 hour and 25 minutes. Please enjoy, and please give me a five-star rating on iTunes. Subscribe on radio.com. The corporate folks love when you go to radio.com, you subscribe to the podcast, you give them a like, all that stuff. It's a really good app, and it's very smooth, and you can listen to all of our programming on my local radio station, Sports Radio 610. Let's do this. All right, Owen Daniels, thanks for coming up, man.
Hell yeah, man.
You've never done a podcast before.
No, it's my first one.
I feel, you know what? I forget that you're not that young. I still, like, in my mind, in my mind, you're always, oh, you're a rookie, and I'm a 10th-year guy, and I'm old,
oh,
and you're young.
Yeah.
But you're kind of old.
Yeah, how old are you?
I'm 43.
Okay. Yeah, I'm 35. I'll be 36.
Yeah, you're not old. You're not old. You're still 36 is like the new 32 at least.
Yeah, I'm trying to make the new 30. Maybe well, set it back 5 years at least.
You know where I realized, like, oh yeah, Owen's got some years on him was when I was looking at your high school, high school football career, and you won the state championship with Naperville in Illinois in 1999.
99 state champs. 6A state champs. Baby.
I've got a theory about that. You're the high school that's a big high school, right?
Yeah,
high school. You're the high school quarterback at a big school that won the state championship.
Yeah.
I don't know when I try to think back on football if it felt any bigger in the NFL than it did when I was in high school. Just because, like, in high school, it's your whole universe.
Oh, man.
And that, so, like, what's a state championship feel like? Now, obviously, in the Super Bowl, you've got the whole world watching and everything. But in terms of the emotion and everything, did it feel that much different to win a Super Bowl?
Honestly, this is bad. That's funny you bring it up because those two championships are my only championships, but those two are so comparable in terms of the feel. And, like, even the high school one felt like, almost maybe it meant a little bit more because at that time it was like you're with all your buddies and it's high school and it's huge.
You've only been alive 17 years.
Yeah, exactly. And our school had never done that before. So it was all these things. There's a lot of, like, anticipation for that year, but man, the feeling of, like, you know, back then, man, football was just so much fun. It was awesome. It was just like you couldn't wait to get out and play the next day. It was just
your body wasn't like you were beat up like you were. I used to get annoyed at high school coaches that would be like, "You guys are young. This shouldn't even feel like work." And like when you're feeling miserable.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It is looking back on it compared to when you're in the NFL.
Winning a championship when I was 17 compared to winning a championship when I was 33, I believe I was. Man, it took everything it took everything out of me that year, my last year.
And
oh
it was
God.
Well, and you're also going to you're
physically,
waking up
mentally.
At like 5 a.m. You got to go to school all day long.
Oh yeah,
and then you have all that pressure. You don't know how to handle pressure when you're that age. I mean, you do, but not to the same degree. So like that pressure feels maybe bigger than it does in the NFL, where you've gotten into your system, and by the time you won a Super Bowl, you really had a process. I'm sure
it was man, it was so like high school. I didn't know any better, so I was just like trying to go out and have fun and. Like we had a really, really good team. So it was one of those things where you didn't have to put too much pressure on yourself because our school was so big and we had, so many guys that came out for the team that I think it was pretty rare in high school football. Nobody played both ways.
Oh, really?
We didn't have one single guy that played both ways. So,
you had a lot of good athletes.
We had a lot of guys.
Cause usually your best athletes are going to do a bunch. Yeah.
You know, 3,000 kids in the school and, yeah, you know, kids have been playing together forever. So, but man, I had so much more anxiety in the NFL.
Oh,
did
you really? Okay,
than I did in high school.
Really? I was the opposite.
It was weird because it seemed like I got more anxious as the years went along, especially late in my career. Like, I was almost like having panic attacks. Like, I'm like, do I want to go play this game today? I'd be okay if they canceled the game.
Really?
Like,
no kidding.
Like my last couple of years.
So well, you were in a lot of pain, weren't you?
It was pain, but it was just like, man, like, oh, I don't know why I was getting more nervous, but maybe because I feel like, oh, this is getting to the end, and, you know, I don't have very many more of these opportunities left to go, so I was, like, anxious on the way to games, and, like,
that's really interesting.
Early in my career,
do you think most guys it's the opposite? I felt like every year I realized, okay, the more energy I expend on game day morning being nervous, that's wasted energy for the game.
Yeah.
And I just kind of tried to learn to, like, approach it. Like, all right, it's just going to be, like, a really focused practice. I'm going to go out there and just play.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying with that. It was just like
– that wasn't your experience.
It wasn't. No, I don't know why. I don't know if it was, like, I wasted energy doing it because I don't think I did that. It was just one of those things where I always got nervous before games.
Yeah.
And I think maybe early in my career – I was like, man, I just got to do my job and just focus on that and just keep my job on the team, keep my starting position, whatever it was. And then everything else just kind of fell into place. And then later I got it, wasn't so worried about that. It was more worried about, I don't know, I was like, man, I'm still playing football. What am I doing?
You have a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Like around 10 years, it's somehow weird. And it probably sounds really weird to people that didn't play because it's not an ungrateful thing or anything. But it's just, it's a strange, I can't even put words to it, where you just feel like I'm playing a game. And, like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Like, I feel like I'm treading water. And I wonder with you, because, okay, you know, you had to change from quarterback to tight end when you're in college, but you're at Wisconsin. You come to the NFL and you fit really well into Gary Kubiak's system. And I think for, let's see, how many years were you in Houston?
Eight years.
So I wonder if part of it was maybe just the fact that you go to Baltimore, then you go to Denver, and in each of those places you got to prove yourself, and there's maybe more pressure in that respect, especially when you're an older guy that doesn't move as fast as some of the younger guys. By that time, your body's not quite the same.
I think that definitely has something to do with that. That's a great point in terms of if I would have spent here my whole career, there wouldn't have been that like. Okay, I gotta prove myself to these new teammates and these new coaches and or this whole new organization or this new fan base, right?
Yeah.
They're just kind of getting to know me, so I think I probably put a lot of pressure on myself those 2 years going those places to kind of make sure that they knew that like the type of player that people got to know me as here, maybe like a consistent guy, a hard worker, and I just want like. Make sure that I proved myself, every week to that fan base. So
it's a weird environment when you walk into a new locker room with guys that don't know you.
Yeah.
And like, no matter what your resume is, I remember when I came here to Houston, I'd been in the league for 5 years and had some success, but it's a whole bunch of brand new guys and every one of them, you know how it is. Like every rookie thinks he's better than you. And,
for sure, man. It's so funny. It's like, running routes and these young guys and like, Now I'm watching those same guys a few years later. I'm like, oh man, that's just like I get it. Like I get where they're coming from and what they're doing. But you walk into the locker room, like Baltimore locker room, you have all those guys that like that core group of guys.
Yeah, yeah. You and got, and those are some, like, there's that whole Baltimore culture too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just, from what I hear from guys that have played there, it's just a different environment.
It is. And I actually really, I really enjoyed it. Yeah. I enjoyed playing for John Harbaugh, like, a ton. I'm really lucky to have played for him and his coaching staff. And Coach Coob fit in well with all that stuff. So
it's just like, a, like, I don't know, is it like blue collar the best way to describe it, or just no nonsense, or just kind of like football guys that are really just hungry for playing football and not much else?
It is. Yeah. There's not exactly like a ton to do, especially like where they have the facility up there. It's just in Owings Mills, Maryland. It's like, where is this place?
Oh, really? Yeah, I know.
It's
I never knew
up,
that.
Like 30 minutes north of Baltimore. So, trying to spend as little time up there as possible, but it's like you're up there, so you might as well, you know, might as well get the most out of it.
Did you spend more time like with your teammates or with? The one thing I'd heard about Baltimore from guys was that there seemed to be a culture, like almost an old school NFL culture, where guys really socialized together and hung out together more than most NFL teams.
I found that I spent probably the most time at the facility in Baltimore of all my years.
Really?
Yeah. So just like, you know, whatever time we start the day, you know, 7:30, whatever it was up there. And then I wouldn't go home till, I probably wouldn't leave the facility till like 5, 6 o'clock, which was, it's honestly super late.
That's putting an 11-hour day, yeah.
Compared to, you know, being here in Houston or being in Denver, schedule just a little bit different. And I don't know, at that time, it was just, they had a lot of older guys that would stick around to take care of their bodies and do all that stuff after practice and all that.
That's good. No, but that training room, like, kind of socialization time or socializing time, is that's some of your favorite times. It's just like,
oh, you're just sitting there, yeah.
Because usually it's an older crowd too.
It is, yeah. It's all those guys. It's like and you actually get to, you know, talk and you get to know guys a little bit during that. So
yeah, it's sitting in the cold tub. This is a quote I had for you since you're talking about how you're trying to prove yourself. This is really interesting. Michael Lombardi, who is a NFL personnel guy, he's on this podcast every week, but he wrote a book called Gridiron Genius. I got to the section where he was talking about Bill Belichick and the game planning, and this is following Belichick through the week before the playoff game from the 2014 season, Ravens versus the Patriots. And I got really excited when I got to this section because it says this: Belichick has great respect for Gary Kubiak, the Ravens offensive coordinator, and mentions the naked bootlegs that are a signature of his offense. Most important, when the Ravens need to make a play, in Belichickian terms, a gotta-have-it play, he expects them to try to get the ball to tight end Owen Daniels or wide receiver Steve Smith. Belichick is so certain about Daniels' key role in the Ravens' attack that he will speak his name more than that of anyone on his own roster this week. And he goes on to kind of illustrate this a few times during the week. He keeps quizzing the team, like, all right, look, they just got a, they went over the Steelers game, said they just converted a big first down.
Sure.
Who do you think the ball's going to? They answer Owen Daniels. Did you feel by the time you got to that playoff game that they were keying on you?
Oh my gosh. That's, you know, I remember pretty much every single game of my career, but that was a huge game. And
that was a slugfest, right?
Oh my gosh. We were up 14 two different times in that game.
Yep.
We were up 14-0 and 28-14 and ended up losing 35-31. And, you know, that was the divisional game to go to the championship game. And, oh man, like, Baltimore's had a lot of success. One of the only teams that had a decent amount of success about even like going up to Foxborough and playing and, you know, winning games up there. They had done it, you know, a few seasons before. And so we felt pretty good about it. And just, you know, they bent some rules a little bit or invented new rules.
Oh, that's right. Well, they had the trick play.
Yeah, well, right? they like declared like a running back ineligible and put him on the line of scrimmage and like ran a lineman
flexed
out.
Flexed out the lineman, right.
Just, like, but had like a tight end in the left tackle position, just ran him down the field a couple times, just got huge chunks, and then
you feel like
getting points.
Yeah, yeah.
Harbaugh was livid. But that's amazing that, like, in that game, we had some opportunities to make plays, and I think that's – I felt like, you know, going into the game, I felt like in that game and similarly in the AFC Championship game when I was in Denver that they're taking away certain people and they're going to force me to beat them.
Okay.
In a sense.
Yeah.
And so it was like a lot of two-man coverages and in-and-out coverages with linebackers and, you know, it's like dealing with Jamie Collins both years. And
so did you actually feel a little bit the opposite? Almost like, okay, if we're going to get beat, we're going to get beat by Owen Daniels? Then,
I feel like if anyone's like, they're like, we're not going to let Steve Smith beat us. Okay. We're not going to let Demaryius Thomas beat us. Yeah. We're going to make Owen Daniels beat us.
Yeah. No kidding. Really? Because so, in the book, Lombardi's saying that, like, man, Owen Daniels is, I think he had, did he have 4 or 5 catches in that game? They were having a hard time stopping you, at least compared to what they wanted to do.
Yeah. I think I had a score that game, too. I had another opportunity to have another score. I wish I had that play back. But
so I wonder if a lot of it was just, like, really keying the linebackers up to be ready for you and knowing your routes and everything. Because that's one thing. I mean, Kubiak, like, you can – people – it drives me nuts when you hear defensive backs say, like, oh, well, we know what routes are coming. Well, all right, great.
There's a finite number of routes that are out there that you can run, you know? Like,
Nobody's inventing any new situation. It's not like Sean McVay has invented a bunch of new routes.
No. It's just like, how are you going to run the route, how you set people up, and it's just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you – so I guess that's the thing that struck me about looking back over your career, and I guess kind of the extension into life is – how well you fit into Kubiak's system. And then because Gary brought you to Baltimore, then he brought you to Denver. And there was, what was it that you figured out about his system or knew about his system to where you matched up well in it?
Man, honestly, if I didn't have Coach Kubiak, I don't know if I would have an NFL career, period.
Really?
But I don't mean just a little tongue in cheek, but like, he was my coach my entire career, and he gave me an opportunity right away from, you know, at some point during training camp, my rookie year in 2006, that they're like, all right, we're going to throw this guy in there and see what he can do. I think I had a good grasp of his offense just from the jump, and I was one of those things where I studied my ass off trying to figure out where, knowing no matter where I was in the field, I can run any play.
Uh-huh.
So he, you know, big thing with
him. That's so for like when you're in motion or wherever they line you, that
in
you
motion,
know what's,
like I could be, because they would really line, you know, they line the Y up or line the U up if we had two tight ends, and you know, all of those spots are kind of interchangeable, depending on the formation. So we run this play out of this formation or the same play out of a different formation. You can have, you know, multiple different routes, right? You want to make sure you know what you're doing in every single situation, and that would actually help me. When I was like, if I go out there, I'm like, oh, shoot. Wait, what is this? What play is this? And I just picture it in my mind. And, you know, you have brain farts like that sometimes. Like, oh, wait, where do I line up? What am I doing? And then you almost, like, figure it out. Like,
that's what
like
I,
reverse engineer it. To
yeah,
like,
oh,
like,
really?
Oh, yeah.
like, think your way through the play. That's why I always try to remember that. Because, like, sometimes I'll get frustrated with Bill O'Brien or somebody for not running more pre-snap motion or
window dressing stuff.
And, you're like, I always try to remember, the window dressing isn't as simple as it seems. Like, it's really, especially when you have young guys out there, it changes everything. Yeah, and it's hard to get guys to do it and not make mistakes.
It is. It's that's why it's like we got to be pretty good at it because we had that, you know, like that core group of that skill position on those Texans teams that, you know, we had 4 or 5 years of those, you know, handful of guys that run the same stuff over and over and over again.
Right.
So.
And also, and I wonder too, maybe they don't get enough credit for being as smart as they were. Like, as a group, you guys had you, Arian Foster, Andre Johnson, a bright
Kevin.
Group of guys. Yeah, Kevin. And I know people get sick of hearing
Casey,
about, like, hey, Kevin's a good blocking wide receiver. Like,
He
was. Like, and I don't think that people ever really appreciated, like, how important that is in Kubiak's scheme. That, like, how you get big chunk plays is because you've got wide receivers that are willing to block downfield.
Yeah, if you're going in there push crack, or if, you know, they had Kevin sifting a lot on the backside of plays, like stuff that tight ends would typically be doing.
Yeah.
They put his – they'd motion him in down in there tight and have him try to cut a defensive end. Like, I know he loved doing that. That was his favorite part.
Well, I remember – from what I remember your rookie year was, you came in and started doing really well real quickly. And Mark Bruner was there already. Mark Bruner's one of my favorite all-time guys, and he was there the first. We were there together for 3 years out of the first 5 years.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
I know. He's like one of the best guys.
Yeah, seriously. Like, how is this guy so nice?
Was there any awkwardness at all? Like when you came in, where you were you were the guy that was not really replacing him because he's a blocking tight end, but you're also gonna get more reps and snaps than Bruner.
Yeah, I mean I think at that time, what, were you guys the same year?
I think he's a little bit older than me.
Yeah, I think it was like his 11th year when I came in.
Yeah.
Something like that, 10th or 11th, 12th year. And I don't know what they had planned. I don't think I was necessarily the guy, like, they drafted me like, all right, he's our starter. Like, they had to see, like, can I do this? Coach Coop does a lot of two tight end stuff. So, yeah. Brew is going to be out there doing – contributing and all that stuff. But he was awesome.
Hard to explain, like, how good a person he is compared how old school, like, violent he was on the football field.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, he was one of the scariest dudes. Like, he used to be our guy when I was in Jacksonville and we played the Steelers. It was like, listen, this guy will kick your ass. Like, you've got to take care of Mark Bruner and know where he is all the time. So when he came to Houston, I was expecting to meet, like, this dude, like, he was getting in fights and bars and everything. Yeah. And he comes up, and he was like, hey, buddy, how you doing? He's complete opposite.
Just the most genuinely nice, like, almost, like, you can't even believe that he is as nice as he is.
Right, right. You know? He almost was like, where's the catcher?
Like, you're not going to believe, like, I don't know who it's only, I think it was maybe Jeb. Jeb Putzier. He's like, yeah, this guy is so nice, you're not going to believe how nice he is. Like, it's just, you're not going to believe him. He's going to be, think he's being fake, but, like, that's his Brew.
Yeah,
man.
That's just him.
Thinking back to, like, me, like, say, myself now, being in year 10, if I had a rookie come in and they had plans for him to be starting, and when I had been a starter my whole career, like, to compare that, and I don't know, I definitely wouldn't have handled it as well as Brew did.
I mean,
and
you wouldn't have made it. I don't think you would have made it outward or anything.
But in terms of
embracing your role is like, oh, that's my job now, is to help bring this guy along.
You know, I didn't realize it at the time because I had no experience with any of that stuff.
Right.
But, like, and I was like, all right, I'm here. We're teammates, and now I'm playing, and it's like, I'm sorry, Brew. I don't take your spot, but like, he was just like. It was never any awkwardness. It was never even a thought of it. So it was like, for you to bring that up, I was like, oh, man, like, it could get awkward. I'm sure it does get awkward with certain positions and certain guys.
I had a guy.
Those scenarios. You know?
I had a friend, Brant Boyer, who's a special teams coach with the Jets right now. And he's just like an all-time funny storyteller. I should just have him on to tell this story. But he was a rookie in Miami when Brian Cox was there.
Oh my gosh.
And when Brian Cox, like, all through the offseason, he'd go golfing with him every day, and Brian Cox was cool as hell to him because they were both linebackers. He kind of took him under his wing a little bit. He shows up to training camp, and he said all of a sudden, like, Brian Cox was a completely different person. Like, Brian Cox flipped into this mode where, like, you little son of a bitch, you think you're going to take my job? And, like, wouldn't talk to him, just hated him. And then once they made the team, complete opposite again. Then all of a sudden, but that's what, like, that's what Brian Cox was so good at doing was Brian Cox tapped into, like, the most psychotic elements he needed to get a guy that runs a 5.140 as a linebacker does. Like, Brian Cox, he supposedly could barely bench 225, couldn't run, like, was athletically a mess. Like, these are the stories told him about it. I don't know what they actually were, but that he was really, he didn't test well or anything, but he got on the field and he was just a complete maniac.
Yeah.
So Brant's got some really good stories.
He could play fast.
Yeah, exactly. You see some guys in practice
fast,
and you're like,
fast.
What the hell is this guy? And you see him on game day. What are you doing now? You walked in and I see this is why I think you're young too. You're doing the young guy thing and you've got the full length tights on underneath your workout shorts.
Yeah, that's it feels awkward if I don't have full length tights on.
Really?
Because I've been wearing these under, you know how they had gotta wear the socks and it's just, I hate wearing the socks.
The game day socks?
Game day socks is just the worst.
Well, they're like out of 1978. They're polyester. It's not a comfortable
thick.
Feel.
It's like not, like, they got better once the, Nike took over. They started having Nike socks.
Oh, okay.
But I just got into the habit of wearing like the long blue tights or the long black tights underneath my pants so I could just wear like short white socks that are not like, you know, squeezing my legs, yeah, all that stuff. And I just got so comfy and you got used to it.
Well, now you don't look, I mean, that's what all the kids are doing these days.
Yeah. So, but
I sweat too much, man. I can't, like, I tried it once and I was like, I went into like a squat workout and which is dumb. I do squats like once every 3 months. I'll go to the gym and do a squat workout and then regret it for the next 2 months.
Oh man. Like, so you put a bar on your back?
Yeah. I get the bruises and everything.
Man. Oh man. Oh yeah. Right across. Oh,
and I always like, it's exactly the same way every time. Like, I'm just going to see how it feels. And I'll get 225 and I'm like, yeah, it feels good. This feels good. And then I'll work my way up to like 355.
Oh man!
and then immediately realize it was a mistake. I get down to the bottom. I'm like, oh, that was it. I have like a weird fantasy every now and then that somehow, I don't know, like I'm gonna start doing athletic things again or something. I hope Dan Riley doesn't listen to this. Our old strength coach.
Yeah,
he'll think I'm an idiot. This is what I worry about, because you've been out of the league how long now? 4 years.
This will be my third season.
I was like, I was probably looking back on it, I might have been clinically depressed for the first 3 years.
Dude, yeah, I mean, the retirement's hard.
It's
getting
this
out
is,
of it.
This
like,
is
transitioning
hard
is hard.
Yeah, and your guy, this is the thing about football players, is that most of the guys that do well in the NFL, even if it doesn't outwardly look like it, most guys are guys that do well with structure. Like, you
100%.
Don't, yeah, yeah, like, you don't, even if you're kind of a renegade, you're a guy that thrives in a team environment with instruction and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you get out of the league, and all of a sudden, it's the exact opposite.
Right.
And the biggest thing I discovered, I think, and finally, was when I actually came back here to do radio, was that I realized that I was, like, I valued my free time too much. Like, I was putting too much priority on my free time when really what I needed was structure.
Yeah.
And, like, because I was, like, I was drinking all the time. I was kind of falling apart. And this is when all the CTE stuff was really coming to the forefront. And you see what happens to guys when they start going that downward spiral. So I just, what are you doing now? Do you have, like, plans for the future or anything?
I think I'm in a similar position to what you were, honestly, to be, like, honest.
Yeah.
Really honest. The whole structure when you're playing, it's like, when you're playing, like, oh, man, I wish I had more free time to do this. Or you actually value your free time more so when you were playing. Like, all right, I'm going to – I know I have this day, or I have this free night where I can sleep in the next day or whatever it is. And you make the most of that. Now it's like, all right, I'm like, I can't wait till I can do that every day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I get to do it every day, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this is not exactly as awesome as I thought it was going to be.
This is not filling up my
this
day.
This is not. Oh man, this is, and it's like, you know, I've been in that type of structure really since I was a freshman in high school, you know? And so that's basically 20 years of super structured life all year long, and now I don't have it. My kids, and you know, maybe go work out or play some golf, but it's like, oh my gosh,
right? Like, there's not you don't. Well, I think the biggest thing is you don't have a goal always, and
like what is my purpose right now? What am I
right? Or what? Like, or what am I even? You know what?
Am I contributing to anything right now?
No, it's completely true. No, it's not. It's not like you're feeling sorry for yourself or anything. That's not like good. People have a drive to produce and do things. I'll just say honestly, I think the whole time you spend playing football, you get conditioned to be like, all right, don't talk about how it's nice to earn money, and like, don't think you care about money. I don't even care if it would be making $7.50 an hour. For me, I like making a buck. Like, I actually just, like, I feel like, okay, this is what I watched my relatives do when I was growing up. Like, they're all farmers and everything. It's like, you're kind of working for a buck.
Yeah.
And maybe you're working for a nonprofit, or maybe you're working for something else. But I like getting a paycheck. And it feels good. You know, like, I wish I still got a paper paycheck, because I like getting a paper paycheck and be like, oh, look at this. I accomplished something over the last couple of weeks. Have you thought about getting, because you were a meteorology major?
Yeah.
Once you get your meteorology degree, can you call yourself a meteorologist, or do you have to get like licensed or something?
I think you can.
Yeah.
I think people call themselves meteorologists with less credentials than a degree. So. But
you can't call yourself like weather boy though.
Yeah. Well,
That's what you should be. You should be the hot weather boy.
The weather boy.
Like pretend you don't have a degree.
Weather boy. Yeah. man. So you can get like certified like American Meteorological Society like certification or but that just takes like
it takes a long
nothing.
Time. Oh really? I okay. Like even without a degree you can
you
get
You
want
to get AM. No, you I think like, if you have a degree and then you can like hey, I went to, you know, went to Wisconsin, got my degree here and I honestly haven't like looked into it, but the people I've spoken to other I've gone to some weather conferences over the years and like, hey, if you want to get certified or you want to like just let me know and we can make it happen.
Yeah.
Like okay.
Is it what
I don't know
what
how
would
that
you
helps me, but
like. Would you want to do that though? Would you want to like do something like what if you started your own, what if you started your own weather website? Just like with a 10-minute video every day.
That's interesting.
Does that intrigue you at all?
I'm really bad with like being creative in terms of ideas.
Yeah.
I am really good at, I think, listening to direction and learning and doing what I'm told to do.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot of people, like, you know, especially this day and age, like, you know, start their own business or
right.
start, you know, I just don't have that type of background and or like expertise in that sense. If you're like, hey, I think you'd be really good at doing this, and like, all right, I'll go do that.
Yeah.
Like I can. That's kind of like how it was for football with me. Like,
and they just give me some instruction.
Yeah,
let me know
instruction,
what to do.
And I'll go do it. Like I.
But that's a scary.
For me to create something on my own is not really my thing.
Yeah.
But to do like if you have an idea, I can make that work for you though.
What's
like,
the scary part for you right now though is that you do have, like you said, the free time kind of gets almost burdensome or stressful in a way. But at the same time, like okay, for you to think about, all right, I'm gonna sign on to some job where I got to be there 5 days a week, 48 to 50 weeks a year. That's scary too.
Yeah,
because
that's
right
very
now,
scary.
I mean, like Henry, your son just went through and is beating cancer.
Yeah.
It was. I'm sure it was really, really helpful to be there a lot.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's been. That's like the silver lining of, you know. Not having to be at work right now is that I can be around my kids a lot and be able to, I didn't have to miss any of his treatments. I get to be there for every single minute of everything, over the summer. So to be able to be available for that and be present for that, meant a lot. It was obviously a very stressful situation for us over the summer. So that was tough, but to be there for him, I would have just hated not being there.
Right.
It would make
right.
me feel like,
when you see people go through that, and I would imagine just like every aspect of your life, like how do you, I would imagine every minute of the day you're there, like you're in your mind, no matter what you're doing every minute, you're going to be preoccupied somewhat with your son and exactly what's going on.
Always thinking about him because there's, you know, we didn't know what to expect in terms of, you know, side effects, reactions from drugs, like. Any little thing that happened to him. So like, here's an example of how like we always had to pay so close attention to everything. I feel like I was taking his temperature just to take his temperature like 10 times a day just to make sure he was good. So he had a port put in so where he could get his chemo
like in treatment. His chest.
So he had a port put in his chest.
Okay.
So instead of poking him and doing an IV every time, they just poke right through into the port, and so he can walk around and be comfortable and not have a tug on him and hurt him. So, but when you have a port, if you get a temperature of not 102, not 104, 100.4,
okay,
it's an emergency room.
Okay, because so, you've got like an access to infection right there.
Yeah,
is that
like
the problem?
So like that's what they're concerned about.
Okay.
So like if you get a temperature and it gets to 100.4 degrees, like all right, you need to go to the emergency room now. And then you get like kind of priority. Because of the situation. So, you know, we're always constantly checking that. Because
like, especially with kids, they can go from 98 to 102 in like an hour.
Yeah, it happens so fast. So that was always on our minds. So just that type of thing like every day.
Yeah. Was he aware that I guess something extra was going on? I mean, like he knows, like what do you tell him?
So we were – We told him everything.
Did you?
So,
okay.
You know, he was young, so he got diagnosed. He was two, and he turned three during the middle of the summer, so kind of right in the middle of his treatments. But he was aware enough to, like, all right, buddy, we're going to go to the doctor. We got to go take a nap. So when we first found out, he had to go take a nap. Uh-huh. So he's got to he took an MRI. He had to put him to sleep to, you know, see where everything was in his body, check out where the tumor was and if there was any more anywhere else. So he had a few of those. So we go take a nap. And then, so he had his robot friends that he got to meet at the hospital. So,
okay. Oh, all the medical devices.
So, like, yeah.
His robot
so,
friends?
So he had two different robots. So he had,
and he's at Texas Children's, right?
Yeah. Okay. So the blue robot every time blue robot does his blood pressure and it takes a temperature, right? So this white robot was the actual infusion robot that, like, you know, the chemo drugs, you know, IV and everything like that. So. He has a white robot friend, has a blue robot friend, so they were his friends. Uh-huh. So they're helping him get better. And he's like, because, you know, we told him he had a tumor, and we had to go to the doctor to make his tumor go bye-bye.
Yeah.
His port's helping his tumor go bye-bye. Uh-huh. So he understood all that stuff. He actually kind of liked going to, I don't say he liked it, but, like, the whole setup at TCH is awesome to where you're not, like, just sitting in a room, mm-hmm. like a crappy hospital room,
It doesn't feel like clinical and scary like
right.
to so a
like,
kid.
There are times where, depending on what drug he was getting, that they had to monitor him in a room for at least like the first 15, 20 minutes of that infusion. And most of these, he was outpatient infusion, so it was nice. Like, it was 3 days in a row. We could pop in the morning and be there for like, you know, 10, 12 hours, but he got to go home at night. But after that monitoring time, we got to go out. He'd drag his white robot. We'd drag it with him, and he'd go out this big open.
Now, does it look like a robot, or is that just what you called it?
It doesn't look like a robot.
Right. I mean,
yeah,
it's not like
it's
some,
like,
Texas Children's thing where they make it look like a robot.
No,
okay.
No, but, like, actually, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
No, it was just like just your standard, you know, infusion machine.
That's going to be my business idea. We're going to do the medical robots.
Like, yeah, make them look all friendly.
Write that down. Okay.
But they had this big open room. I'm talking, it was like three stories open, like tall, open, like glass windows. And so you got a lot of natural light in there. And they had all the, you know, like a bunch of kids, bunch of patients just in there. They had toys, TVs in there. So it didn't feel like, you know, you're in there getting chemo. You know, it's like at least he was shooting hoops while he was all hooked up.
Really?
And, you know, playing with cars and almost like making friends in there, you know, with other kids doing the same stuff. So,
it's kind
about
of
as good as you can get it over there.
Is he the oldest grandkid for your parents?
He's
okay.
The first one. Yeah.
So your whole family. This is.
it was crazy.
This
man.
This is big stuff they're dealing with their 2-year-old grandson and nephew. Your two brothers. Were they able to come down at all? Are they both here? Are they here?
So
still?
They no. The youngest one is here still.
Okay.
Harrison.
Harrison's the one that went to Illinois, right?
Harrison went to Princeton.
Harrison went to Princeton, and Hayden went to Illinois.
Illinois, but then finished up at U of H.
Okay.
So Hayden's still down here. Harrison lives in San Fran, and my sister lives in Boston. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of outside visitors from, like, out of town during this, you know, during the time of his treatments, just because he was, you know, immunocompromised, and we didn't want to bring any extra, you know, outside stuff coming in. So he didn't get to see a lot of friends over the summer. He missed birthdays. He didn't have a birthday party of his own. So there's a lot of things that he had missed just because we were, you know, being careful about, you know, his immune system was down for the most part. But they got, you know, talked to him, FaceTime with him. Everyone was awesome about it. But it was one of those situations, like, for us, it was just, like, just survival mode. Because when we find out about stuff, it's like, all right. Now we do this, and now we do this, and now we do this, and it's just kind of like,
and you just
that,
try
that
to,
was
you
my
just try
mindset.
Try to lay it like almost like, all right, here's our objective. Like, this is what we attack next.
Yeah.
And I was like, Angela's a former public prosecutor. I got to guess she's kind of got an aggressive mindset about stuff.
Well, yeah, she's the reason that Henry is alive today, I think.
Right.
Or
well,
that he's in the, like, his status is what it is now, and he's like, prognosis is very favorable for the future because of just my wife's awareness when he was playing outside one day.
Right. He said he got red. He just kind of got red and stayed
so
red.
Half his face got red.
Yeah.
And sweaty.
Uh-huh.
And the other side was pale and dry.
Uh-huh.
And my wife's like, this is kind of strange. And I had seen it the day before. But I made an excuse for it. I was like, oh, no, the sun was on that side of his face. He was shooting out, he was, like, shooting hoops outside. Sun was on that side of his face. Like, that's why that side of his face is red.
Yeah. And yeah, looked up, you would have, like, if you were single dad, it would have gone on for a while.
It was, yeah, I would have probably wouldn't.
You would have turned him over to get a tan on the other side of his face.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like, he'd still be sitting here and not knowing about his situation. So she's like, all right, well, we got to get this checked out. And sure enough, like, yeah. The tumor was causing that. It's called anhidrosis, is the symptom of this thing called Horner syndrome, which he got diagnosed with. And then the cause of Horner's is typically a neuroblastoma or a tumor in a certain situation, a certain spot. So, yeah, man, he still has that. He probably always will.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just because the nerves were damaged.
Okay. But you take the cancer out. So it still has
Yeah, so the tumor's out of there. And we found out next week if it's anywhere else in his body, just a rescan. And it hasn't been from the start. So hopefully it still won't be. But it's one of those things where, like, neuroblastoma is actually kind of like a self-explanatory. Like, it is like a neuron blast.
Okay.
Like a like in the fetus, the neuron like explodes.
Oh,
like,
really?
Okay. It happens before he's even born.
Okay.
So he's been living with it for his whole life, and then those cells around that neuron just don't mature.
Okay.
And they reproduce that way, but.
I think you should coin that phrase, though, too. That sounds a lot cooler for a kid, the neuron blast.
Neuroblastoma.
I'm telling you, you're stumbling onto your next career already, like coming up with cool things for kids in hospitals to make it more Texas Children's will fund it for you.
I like it. I like it. We got to work with them a little bit more on that.
Are you?
Yes. I don't know where we're going with that, but We were just talking about
just where you are right now, and you got to go on. I mean, you're going to monitor it for a long, long time. Obviously, he keeps checking.
Oh yeah, the anhidrosis thing. Yeah, so his those nerves were damaged, and it'll always be like that. And so his left eye is a little bit smaller than his right eye.
Okay,
and that happens with a lot of people. And my wife actually had the same thing. And that's something that probably won't like come back either. Mm-hmm. It's just something that just is going to be what it is. And it's more apparent when he's like tired at the end of the day. It's like that eye is like kind of drooping
looks droopy. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just another, symptom of the Horner syndrome.
You know what? If there's one thing I've noticed about kids, like compared to, I think when we grew up, And I think a lot of this started back around Columbine because there started to be such a focus on anti-bullying with schools. Kids, to generalize, to me, it seems like they're a lot nicer. And when it comes to just picking on kids that have something different about them, I just don't know. Like, they don't – maybe it changes once they get to junior high. I'm sure it does.
Yeah.
I just don't think they don't point it out or make a deal out of it the way they used to. That's just been my experience, at least.
I'll wait and find out.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of just, he goes to his preschool. They're three-year-old kids, so.
Yeah. Three-year-olds aren't, they don't mean anything by it. They just say,
they're just maybe observing, or like, just staying in observation they have. They're I don't think they even have the ability to, make fun of somebody because
Right.
I don't even know what it is. So,
yeah, exactly.
Or how to make fun of somebody yet.
Yeah. You'll learn, kid.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the question I wanted to ask you about just being a meteorologist in Houston, or at least trained as a meteorologist in college. I've seen you tweet about this at times, but, look, we're in, the oil and gas capital of the world. Yeah. When the subject of global warming comes up, how do you handle, because honestly, when it comes to things that are politically charged scientific topics, I always try to look at the other side, and I just frankly I've read various opinions about why people don't think that global warming is real, and nothing's ever latched on with me. I'm very much on the mainstream of most scientists and how they feel about it. What's the biggest objection you hear to global warming? Like, as far, or do people just not talk to you about it?
The biggest objection,
yeah,
they just think it's like they want to harp on that it had been warmer.
Previously. Like, okay, this drives me nuts, because people will bring up like the fourth grade earth science stuff. They're like, where they say, well, you know, there are cycles of warming and cooling, and this is just one of them. But like, yes, I know that. I learned it in fourth grade about the cycle, and most meteorologists or climatologists understand that too. So you haven't generally people aren't presenting you with things that you don't already know.
No, I don't know why people want to be opposed to it if it's something that's happened. I just don't understand, like, why are you denying it? What for? What?
Right.
Like, I feel like there's tons of opportunities energy wise to make money off of this situation. Like, and that's what it's all about for them anyway, right? So other energy sources, like these same companies, the oil companies, like, they can use their money to fund this other approach to energy, and they can find ways to make money off it. I just, you know,
I don't. Yeah. And I guess the motivation, it usually comes back to that in some respect. On one level, I guess what bothers me is that's at the very upper levels of decision makers, but where it filters down to people that, like, won't be affected in the immediate short term, still wanting to deny something that's happening and is that is plainly obvious. I don't quite, you know, I used to get into arguments, which you can imagine how this went for me, about religion and and about
that's
just
good.
Well, let's say the topic of evolution.
Yeah.
And like, for me, that it came from, you know, I had started off as a biology major, and I know a few things here and there, and I would get these objections about the theory of evolution where it would just get really frustrating with me, because I'd have to argue with people telling me that evolution, the theory of evolution, says things that it does not say. They'll claim that, scientists think they have all the answers. And I'm like, well, no, they don't. They really, like, the whole concept of science is saying, I don't know the answer. I'd like to learn more about the universe, you know.
Exactly.
So I would imagine, but for the most part, I've come to peace with how to talk to people about these things, and I'm not as combative as I used to be.
Sure.
And I can have a good conversation with somebody about, and honestly, a lot of it came from working at children's hospitals, because I used to be very just bombastic, annoyingly I would debate things when I didn't need to. Mm-hmm. And when you start working in children's hospitals and you meet families whose kids have terminal illness, you realize, like, oh, okay, like, I'm not in really the mood to try to take something away from them that they're using for emotional support.
Sure.
And then also, like, okay, what am I not getting here that they are? But you generally, you don't seem like somebody that probably gets in a whole lot of shouting arguments with people.
See, I've gotten into a couple situations where, like, one of my brothers, like, has a coworker or something like that. Like, hey, he doesn't believe in this. it gassed me up. I'm like, oh man, now I gotta go talk to this guy. I had a couple, an event, had a couple beers, had talking to this guy, and it's like, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
This guy starts, spouting off and, bringing up stuff that makes no sense. But the thing is, I've always been a science guy.
Uh-huh.
Like, seems like you have that science background. So, scientists, have no agenda. They're
right.
Not trying to prove something that they want because they believe in it.
Because the greatest way to achieve notoriety as a scientist is to disprove something, or to prove,
they try their hardest to disprove what's happening. You know,
right.
they go at length to do that,
and to disprove the new idea that does eventually become consensus. People go to great lengths to test that and see if that should be consensus.
Yeah, if scientists find something out, sure, this looks like global warming, man, let's do everything we can to debunk this. It's not global warming. But if it keeps showing that it is, that's the thing that people feel like, certain people that don't have a science background just think that there's some agenda. And there's, I've been looking at this, when we've been talking. American Meteorological Society responded to Donald Trump about the comments he made recently on a 60 Minutes. I don't know if I retweeted it, but I favorited it. And so it's the way they worded this, they wrote a letter to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they word the letter, and it's very scientific in terms of like let me read an excerpt of it. Okay. You said that scientists are making this political, which is misleading and very damaging. That scientific community welcomes all who commit to the pursuit of understanding through science, irrespective of their political views, religious beliefs, and ethical values. As an institution, the American Meteorological Society takes no political positions, and we proudly count among our members both individuals who strongly support you and those who routinely disagree with you. We're stronger for the breadth of our membership. So like it's like he thinks that there's just like people that don't like him,
right? That have this opinion pushing this agenda because Obama.
Actually,
got
there's
him a
people
job
on both
something.
Sides that they like you, they hate you, but or they all agree on this.
Yeah,
that, obvious thing.
And this is honestly, this is what I've always wondered about with environmentalism. And this is what bothers me too, is just that, like, most of my conservative friends, I'll say this, most of my friends that are most into like hunting and fishing and spending time outdoors are politically conservative.
Right.
And I don't understand like the goals of what I like to do in my leisure time, which is spend a lot of time outside in clean air and fresh water and everything, are kind of consistent with the same things that would help reduce carbon emissions also. For me, I would like both. Even if I didn't agree with global warming or the theory of global warming or climate change or whatever the hell people have been forced to talk about it these days, I would like to have those things anyway.
maybe just like it's been worded wrong this whole time. And it's just like the climate change, global warming, like maybe people don't like those terms, but it's like, yeah. Like
but
you
a
said,
simple
like,
clean air
we
initiative.
We want clean air.
Right.
We want clean water.
Well, you know what's in the here
don't
and now.
We do what we can do to make those things
right. And part of the problem too is whenever you're predicting something off in the future, there's a tendency because for one, predictions aren't accurate. They might be right totally, but when you predict that climate's going to change by a certain amount within the next 30 years, and it only changes by X amount instead of Y amount, then it looks like you were wrong with your prediction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Versus like okay with. Ozone, with air quality, with these other things, we can see very clear correlations to poor health. You know, we can see asthma rates. We can see heart disease in city. Like, we can see exactly what happens when you don't have clean air, clean water. You can see what's happening with the red tide on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
And that maybe it's as simple as that as far as actually showing, like, okay, look, kids are dying like because of dirty air. Like can we at least handle this problem that's right here? And
whatever's causing that, who cares? Like I don't know, people who are like focused on why it's happening or it's like it is happening.
Yeah.
So like let's do what we can. Right?
Well,
it's like this like so it seems so simple to me, and people just complicate it so much.
I'm glad I got you onto this because now you'll get reached out to by many many people after the
Oh, it'll be good. It'll be good. it'll be good. I'm like tend to like when I like when I like retweet something or it's like and out because I kind of tend to be on the. I would say not the conservative side, like probably like a progressive side of like just things in general, like whatever climate change or whether it's, you know, taking a knee or like supporting certain, you know, rights, you know, so like, and I will go out on Twitter and like support somebody with that or like, call somebody out for something like that, and then it's just like,
and
where
you're not
down.
Even necessarily making a huge point, but you're just showing a little side of yourself. That I made a joke about Brexit during the Astros game last night. That wasn't even a political joke, and I had people. I don't even know which side Trump is on in Brexit or anything, but apparently I was on the wrong side of it. Like all I remember was like when there were people that voted for Brexit in Britain that immediately expressed regret afterwards,
right.
Like which was funny to me because it was it's.
Do you?
It's, so anyway, there was a facial expression of Josh James, which kind of looked exactly. There was a guy that had said he had voted for Brexit but didn't expect it to pass. So after it passed, he was like, "No!"
Yeah,
like that's exactly what it looked like. Kind of like, "Oh no, what did I do?" And I almost like people were coming at me about that. I don't know. I just want to make political jokes.
I'm sure.
But not
because I'm sure all those people know exactly what Brexit is and like how it affects everything else over there.
Well, that's where I miss the days when you could make like bipartisan political jokes. I feel like Johnny Carson and those guys back in the day probably took shots at both sides, and the people didn't get too worked up about it. But they also didn't have Twitter. If Johnny Carson had Twitter and he would have had 20 million followers, he's going to get a bunch of responses every time he picks on Eisenhower or every time he picks on Kennedy. And so I always, you have to remember that. And I talked to Wade Smith about this a little bit too, that like, no matter, even when you're winning an argument, like in the public consciousness, especially in anything political, you've still got 40% of people opposed to you. So you can't get too wrapped up in like, wow, I can't believe these people are being jerks to me. Like, that's just life. That's advice I give but don't follow. I'm very bad at it. That's why I stay out of politics publicly as much as possible.
You're going to see it too because, you know, everyone has a voice on those platforms. So it's like you're going to see you will see both sides for sure.
Right.
And you'll get a lot of it.
And you'll get a lot of lowest common denominator responses too. And that's what I think happens is people sometimes, and right now what happens is a lot of intelligent people on both sides of any issue, unfortunately, because we have an inherently negative bias in our brains to look for negative because we want to in nature, we need to watch out for things that are threats. So I think when you see all these possible opinions, you almost gravitate to the dumbest, scariest opinion on the other side.
You start to believe
that all liberals are socialists or all conservatives are racists or all of this. And I don't know what the answer or the solution is other than people got to just try to curate your newsfeed a little bit better.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the thing. Like, I want both sides. I want to be able to read both sides. Like, I want to follow people that are super conservative. I want to follow people that are on the other end of that.
Right.
Just to kind of skip both sides. Like, what are these people? Why are these people saying this? Why are these people saying that? Why they feel the way they feel? All on just your beliefs, and you're just reading people like that. And it's like,
I know that on any given topic, there are people who are much smarter than me that disagree with me. But there are also people that are smarter than me that agree with me. So I do like to hear the opinion of people that are smarter than me that disagree with me. And usually what it comes down to is perspective or whatever your actual needs, your material needs are, or your emotional needs, or whatever you're taught by your family.
Right.
And then the challenge is finding that common ground, which is with the environment. You've got people that have never hunted or fished but care about the future of the planet, and then you got people that hunt and fish and live in the country and that also care about that. I don't know. You're old enough that you pretty much missed social media while you were playing, for the most part, right? Or at least it hadn't really blown
thankfully,
up.
Thankfully, yeah.
So honestly, you didn't? Did you even have Twitter when you were playing?
I had Twitter. Okay. Yeah. So Twitter kind of got rolling. 2000.
I think it was invented in 2007 and then got big in 9 and 10 or so.
Yeah, so that's when I got – I think I got involved beginning of 2010 maybe or end of 2009.
Uh-huh.
Or beginning of 2000 – anyway, somewhere in the 2009 area, and I was I'm just glad that it wasn't what it is now back then.
Right.
Because – I would just say stupid stuff and
you better go back.
Not stupid stuff. I have gone back. I think I have a couple years, a few years ago. I go back, dang, what did I say back in 2009? What was I tweeting out that if I tweeted out now, it would just be just a disaster.
It
was crazy stuff. It's why did I say that?
Right.
It's just dumb.
I do every now and then. I do a keyword search of Seth Payne and just to be sure. Did I ever quote a lyric or anything? I got to be absolutely positive that I've never done anything. Maybe I was drunk and somebody took my phone. I think I'm in the clear. I did. So anybody listening, don't try to go back. It's a waste.
No, there's nothing. There's nothing there.
It's a waste of your time. I appreciate you coming in, man.
Yeah, man.
Your first ever just sole podcast interview. I feel like I've introduced you to a whole new world.
That was fun.
Now, what I'll do is you'll start a podcast and I'll tell you what to do.
I can talk about those things. I don't come up with it on my own.
And then give you the structure and everything, and then you can go do it.
And I'll make it work.
Right. Okay. Good. I'm glad. It was good to hire you, man.
Boss. Yeah.
Awesome. Let me stop this before you say anything more that might incriminate you. There you go. Of course, Owen Daniels has nothing incriminating to say about anybody or anything or himself as well. And now we have on Sean Pendergast. Sean, a lot of you might not know this, even people that listen to him on his show. He was a three-time Smack-Off champion on Jim Rome's radio show. For those of you who are unfamiliar with that, that's where callers once a year call in and compete for having the best takes. It's a really, really cool thing. I don't listen to Jim Rome that much anymore, but he's a legend. And that's how Sean got his start in the business. He was just a successful business dude doing business things, but he was really good at calling into sports radio shows. And then he started getting opportunities in Houston. I think with 1560 back in the day was his first full-time gig, and he just built himself up from there. So he has a degree from Notre Dame. We talk a little bit about Notre Dame this week, and was very successful in business, but his dream was to do sports radio, and he created a career for himself. He's putting three kids through college at good colleges with the money he's making in sports radio. It is possible. Don't let anybody tell you that the money in sports radio sucks. That is a bunch of sports radio hosts trying to make themselves seem more relatable to everybody else, and the fact of the matter is you can make pretty good coins. So if you kids actually want that as a dream, don't let anybody talk you out of it by telling you it's an unreasonable job or you're not going to make that much money. You can be very, very, very comfortable. And look, you're not going to, unless you're Colin Cowherd or somebody, you're not going to be blisteringly rich, but you can make a good living. So go after your dreams. And it's not all about the money anyway, but it's nice to make a good living doing something you love. That's exactly what Sean Pendergast is doing. Sean Pendergast, I have to tell you, as I was sitting here setting up, I was looking up at the screen, and they were doing something about Michigan versus Notre Dame earlier this season.
Yeah.
You're a Notre Dame grad. And the thought I had was, you've got three kids in college.
Yes.
None of them go to Notre Dame. Are you a little bit, I don't know if upset's the right word, do you wish that one of them had gone to Notre Dame, especially when Notre Dame is doing what they're doing football-wise?
Yeah, for sure. The boys, and I'm not speaking out of turn by saying this, I don't know that they would have gotten in. Uh-huh. I mean, they're smart. They're going to good schools. They're going to TCU and Baylor. But Notre Dame is way harder to get into now than when I went there. I don't know if
is
I would
is it really?
Gone. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
A lot harder than the Lou Holtz days for football players.
Yeah. Yeah. So right. That's right. Lou got to work with a different set of rules than the coaches since Lou.
Lou was like, if all of a sudden Stanford was like, all right, listen, we'll let lots of guys in. Like, you get the benefit of the Stanford reputation, yeah, plus lowering the academic standards.
Yeah, that's we could do a podcast with Lou Holtz stories someday. But my daughter is probably the one who had the best chance to go because of sports. And she's smart. She goes to Harvard now,
right.
So she's a smart kid. But she was an elite cross-country runner, and she went and had a visit at Notre Dame, and she didn't like the coach there. And there was a little part of me that was like, oh, I wish she had liked the coach.
Yeah.
That would have been really cool not to just see her go there, but play sports there too. But
well, and she'd be competing in the fall. You'd go up, you'd watch a cross-country race, then go to a football game.
Go to a
game.
Football game and fly back on Sunday morning for NFL stuff. So, a little bit. But they're at the end of the day, they're all super happy where they are. And that's, like, I know it sounds cliche, but they're my kids. So, like, as long as they're happy where they are, that's all I care
about. Oh, gosh, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, but it's okay every now and then.
I do let my mind wander sometimes during football season and think, especially a season like this where Notre Dame is really good. When I was there, so 1987 through 1990 were the football seasons that I was there. It was Lou Holtz's second year, was my freshman year. Tim Brown won the Heisman my freshman year. They won the national championship my sophomore year. That was the Catholics versus Convicts year. My junior year, they went 12-1 and finished number 2 in the country to Miami, who they lost to. That was a one loss. And then my senior year, I think they finished 9-3 that year, but they went to the Orange Bowl. That was the Orange Bowl where they called the clip on the Rocket Ishmael punt return, and Rocket Ishmael was second for the Heisman that year. So those were four really good years to be there. They've been, as everybody knows, up and down since then. So years like this, I do think, like, man, that would be cool, especially when my sons are kind of experiencing kind of wonky football years at the schools they're at. And they're huge football fans. TCU and Baylor, you know, TCU's 500 and Baylor is just, you know, not what they were a few years ago. So, yeah, a little bit.
It's kind of a good transition to what I want to ask you about before we get to your picks,
yeah,
which, by the way, you were undefeated last week.
6-0.
Any of our listeners that were using Sean's advice, you're welcome.
Yeah. That was the deceptively fast karma, baby.
So, since you mentioned a couple of Big 12 football schools,
mm-hmm,
This is the talk, obviously, is the increased offense in the NFL this year. And it's the NFL is becoming the Big 12. The average yard per attempt in the passing game is 7.4 yards per attempt, which is what college football had in 2015. So, like, football has already surpassed what college football was in 2015. It's becoming the Big 12 in a lot of respects. I'm having a hard time getting upset about it. I see various other guys, like Lewis Reddick was venting about how atrocious defenses are right now. Look, it's no secret why they're bad.
Yeah.
It's because offensive rules have gotten more and more lax, and then safety rules have even exaggerated the situation. Yeah. And I'm enjoying some of these high-scoring games.
Yeah, I am too. I guess I think some of it is – you know, the concepts of college are now coming to the pros. Mm-hmm. Like these offensive coordinators are looking at what's working in college. They're looking at ways to recoup their investment on these quarterbacks quicker. And some ways to get the quarterbacks on the field quicker is to incorporate some of the things that a lot of them are doing at the collegiate level. You got to take advantage of those 4 or 5 years that you've got these guys on rookie deals. So I think there's some of that. I'm going to watch football regardless, you know, like the same way I'm going to eat pizza regardless,
right.
You know, like even a good pizza, bad pizza, if there's pizza there on the counter, I'm going to sit and eat 3 or 4 slices of pizza. So it's not one of those things where it's ruining the experience for me or anything like that. I will say this, like I probably skew more towards what Lewis Riddick is saying in this, and that I do like my games to have elements of both, you know, all three really, offense, defense, and special teams. I do like thinking that there is a certain futility when you're watching a game like New England and Kansas City on Sunday night where it's just back and forth. It ends up 43-40.
It turns into like a 1980s basketball game.
Yeah, or a tennis match, right?
Right?
Like you're waiting for the first team to break serve. Like that, literally, that's what you're waiting for. Like the first team to be able to get off the field on third down is like breaking serve in a tennis match. And I don't know, like I don't know how I feel about that. Like I like that football before the scoring went up and before the rules really started favoring the offense, you had to kind of earn your way. You had to earn your way into the end zone. It's a microcosm for what's going on in society today with nudity, Seth. Like back in the day, we had to earn our nudity.
Yeah, right?
You had to have.
That's right. Yeah, you had to look through scrambled television boxes.
Scrambled television boxes. You had to have a buddy whose dad subscribed to Playboy and stored all the old issues like under the bed or something like that.
Those guys were the best. The Sandersons, the Sanderson twins. Their dad was awesome.
The Thompsons for me.
Okay, good.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you'd go up there and you'd sit in a treehouse and look at Playboys with 3 or 4 of your buddies and wonder what was next.
It really, I tell you what, in terms of helping your kids be popular, that's so much more cost effective than a pool, which was like the Sandersons. There were two kids, Jake Basta, who passed away. God rest your soul, Jake. He had a lot of visitors after school because he had a pool.
Yeah.
But then the Sandersons, who lived like 3 doors down, their dad had a nudie collection that was open access.
Dude, $79 a year,
yeah.
And your kid is the most popular guy in the class. So, yeah, like, you know, nowadays, all they got to do is pull up their phone, and that's not even just nudity. Like, we had to work just to get, like, boobs and a hint of downstairs in Playboy. Like, nowadays, like, kids can just go watch hardcore porn on their phones. And I feel like, Seth, that is a microcosm of what's going on in the NFL. Teams don't need to earn their way into the end zone anymore.
The pornification of America has finally reached the NFL. And Roger Goodell, I'm sure, is just horrified
by it.
He's actually happy about the offense. This would be the other thing, and there will be a little bit of a local bias here since Sean and I are both based in Houston.
Yeah.
And we're getting more and more listeners from outside of Houston. Which
I was just going to ask you. That sounds like a non-local geographical tease or an olive branch.
Well, wait until they get to our Jacksonville, Houston picks, and then people will see that we're completely divorced from the city of Houston. I'm gonna have you listen to this real quick. This is Bill Belichick talking about whether or not Khalil Mack is in the same category as Lawrence Taylor.
Yeah, I'm not putting anybody in Lawrence Taylor's class. So you put everybody down below that. That's with a lot of respect to a lot of good players now, but we're talking about Lawrence. Yeah, I'm not putting anybody in Lawrence Taylor's class. So
you hear that.
Yeah.
And immediately what you think is, wait a second. Back in 2015,
yeah,
when J.J. Watt was on his way to his third defensive MVP of the year, an honor which he shares with Lawrence Taylor, Bill Belichick said this: there are very few players I would put in the same conversation with Lawrence Taylor. I would put J.J. there. he's a dynamic player. He can ruin a game. He's a special player. He was the defensive MVP, and then he went on and on. And then last year he actually said something similar, talked about him in the same conversation.
Yeah.
I feel like this is not anything Belichick would do on purpose, but almost like a subconscious retroactive snipe at J.J. Watt.
Yeah, it would be. If it's that, it's evil genius. I was thinking about this with respect to J.J. because I remembered the quotes you were bringing up. I wonder with Belichick, I wonder if it's one of those things where Belichick is so hyper-focused on what's in front of him, okay, and what is, you know, just what the next thing is. Like, he strikes me as a guy who, doesn't look past the next week, like, unless absolutely necessary. So this is what I wonder. I wonder if Belichick is making a categorization that's in the moment, that's right now, about there is currently nobody who's in Lawrence Taylor's class. Now, you would say to yourself, well, J.J. Watt is kind of back to being J.J. Watt, right? 7 sacks. He is just behind Khalil Mack in the odds for Defensive Player of the Year right now. But to the point of the hyper-focus of Belichick, the only impression that Belichick has of J.J. Watt, because he has no need to watch J.J. Watt film anymore unless they meet in the in the postseason.
Well, they might, though. That's we'll get to the showdown in the AFC South later in the episode.
Yeah. But Belichick, essentially anything having to do with J.J. Watt in the now is cast off to the side because they met in week 1. Yeah. And in that week 1 game, J.J. Watt did not have a game where you would put him on the same plateau with a Lawrence Taylor. So it could be an in-the-moment evaluation in his head where he thinks currently – there is no defensive player on the planet as good as Lawrence Taylor.
I wonder if when he first said that in 2015, there was a whole – you remember Mike Francesa, however the hell you pronounce his name.
Yeah.
Mike Francesa went off on it, and it spawned all kinds of debate. I felt it was good for Lawrence Taylor because, well, with this latest quote too, people are having this huge debate and remembering how awesome Lawrence Taylor is.
That's funny you bring that up. This happened yesterday on the show. You know, we have Cecil Shorts in every Wednesday.
Yeah.
And during one of the breaks, I'm talking to Cecil. And Cecil, a 6-year NFL guy who came into the league in 2011, you know, so 25 years after Lawrence Taylor's prime. But I just thought it was interesting. Cecil goes, how good was Lawrence Taylor?
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, I felt really old in the moment, man. Yeah. I'm thinking, wow. You know, I told him. I said, he may be the best defensive player I've ever seen. It's between him, Reggie White, and J.J. Watt as the 3 best defensive players that I've seen in my lifetime. I proceeded to explain how awesome Lawrence Taylor was on Tecmo Bowl to him, which he found very funny. But it was an eye-opening thing to me, to the point of what you're talking about, the revived relevance of Lawrence Taylor. It is kind of out of sight, out of mind, these older players. You know, like Lawrence Taylor's probably pushing 60 now, you know. So it probably was good for Lawrence Taylor, and people probably did go to YouTube and go look. And if you do go to YouTube and watch Lawrence Taylor, holy crap, that is one guy from back in the 80s whose game would translate today.
You know what does a disservice to players from the 80s is that everybody wore oversized shoulder pads.
Yes!
They end up looking – it's kind of like how baseball players now, you can't appreciate their physiques necessarily because they wear baggy jerseys.
It's like pajamas.
And then you see them in the clubhouse and you're like, holy crap.
Right.
These guys are bodybuilders.
Right. I was looking at Springer yesterday when he got on base, and the way his uniform fits him, he looks like he's got like a little Joe hanging over his belly.
And then Altuve, you see him in a T-shirt, and he's a little bodybuilder,
he's
you know?
He's shredded.
But you wouldn't notice it from their jerseys. That's what 80s football players look like. And a lot of those guys, that was before they started testing in the late 80s. Those guys were, the offensive linemen were like 255, 265, and shredded.
Yeah.
Like veiny Mike Webster arms.
That would be great if there were some way to computer superimpose like 2018 pads onto Deion Sanders.
Like Michael Bennett. He wears those non-pads.
Right,
it looks
like
he's wearing a wife beater more than shoulder pads.
Yeah, go back and watch like a Deion Sanders punt return from when he was at FSU.
Yeah.
He has the shoulder pads of a left tackle on, and he's doing that. Like, how do guys catch the ball? Like, how did you get your arms up in the air to catch a ball with those gigantic shoulder pads?
Quarterbacks,
on?
Too.
Yeah.
Just to the range of motion. And I don't know why it took so long. Bruce Smith started wearing the smaller shoulder pads, and then it really caught on because it's less to grab onto.
They were focused on the wrong things. Like, they were focused back in the 70s on having, like, the one-bar face. Like, Joe Theismann flipping over to the one bar, like the punters and kickers. It's like, no, bro, you need to work on those shoulder pads.
So let's get to your NFL picks.
Yeah.
I agree with, I think, 2 of these. One, I've got questions about. Okay. And it's this one. You're taking the 49ers, who are plus 11 versus the Rams.
Love that pick.
Give me the this is what I'm thinking. This is the big one for me. The Rams are the Rams. The Rams have scored fewer than 33 points just once this season.
Right.
It was last week
right.
versus the Broncos.
Right.
But the big one for me is that the Broncos have the worst turnover differential in the league. The Rams hardly ever turn the ball over. They've turned the ball over six times. So I don't see any wild cards in this game.
Yeah.
I don't see the 49ers all of a sudden flipping the script with a couple of turnovers and gaining an edge over the Rams.
Yeah.
I see this game going like you would expect the Rams offense to look.
Yeah. Here's what I like. I like a few things about this game. One is, just as a general rule for me in the NFL, when you have a double-digit spread in a division game, I take the underdog, just because those games are, you know, that the intensity of that game is going to be more than just your average garden variety game. Like, both teams are going to come to play. The other things I like about this game, so 11 points is a lot of points, especially on the road.
Uh-huh.
They're, if I'm not mistaken, the game is in San Francisco, if I am correct about this. Let me just double check. And yeah, it's in San Francisco. So this is three straight road games for the Rams in three pretty difficult places to play, at least the previous two pretty difficult places to play. They were in Seattle 2 weeks ago. They lost that. Well, they won that game, but Seattle covered. You remember that was one of the bets I gave out on the podcast. Last week, they had to go to Denver to Elevation and play. Denver got a backdoor cover in that game, but they covered. So on the scoreboard, it was a close game. Now you're playing a third straight road game. It's a division game. San Francisco's been a little friskier than I think people anticipated they would be without Jimmy Garoppolo. CJ Beathard's been good, but I think more importantly, Kyle Shanahan has been good. I trust Kyle Shanahan. I trust Kyle Shanahan in a game where the opponent is going to be a little road weary, maybe a lot road weary, coming off of a game in Denver, to scheme San Francisco into enough points to cover an 11-point spread. The other thing is, this Rams defense has not been as good as people thought it would be.
Right.
It's 17th in DVOA right now. So it's a, by that standard, which I think is a, as statistics go, that's a pretty good one. They're a below-average defense.
And I could see the 49ers, whose leading receivers are their fullback and a tight end.
Right.
Still playing a grinded-out type of game where they limit the Rams' possessions.
Especially
so
if they
get a
lead.
You keep the under, and the Rams get a healthy lead perhaps, but aren't able to just rack it up.
That's
the way
a great point. If you think it's going to play out that way, if you think it's going to be a game where the 49ers try to kind of shorten the game, then 11 points becomes even more valuable in that game.
Okay, so you've got Chiefs minus 5.5 versus the Bengals.
Yeah.
This is one I agree with, and this is one of the big factors in this game, and I am eagerly looking forward to this. Vontaze Burfict has this play last week where he hits Antonio Brown with his forearm. And then, according to Ben Roethlisberger, said that after that play, Burfict pointed to Juju Smith-Schuster and declared, "You're next." So this is Vontaze Burfict being peak Vontaze Burfict. And yet, getting away with it.
Yeah.
No suspension, no punishment, no of note for this play. And we know this of Vontaze Burfict. Like, if you give him an inch, he'll take a cranium.
Right.
I think this is the week that Vontaze Burfict just flat out goes off, loses it,
melts down. Yeah.
Has a complete meltdown. And then beyond that, too, look, Mahomes has turned the ball over twice in the last two games. He's starting to look a little bit more like people might have expected him to look.
Yeah.
But the Bengals are not a great pass defense, and I don't think they can take advantage of that the way some other teams might.
Game's in Kansas City, so the crowd is going to be hyped for that game. It's two straight Sunday night games for them, but this one's back at home. They gave the Patriots a great game on Sunday night. I feel like the Chiefs came out of that game on Sunday night against the Patriots actually feeling pretty good about themselves.
Yeah.
The way they came back in the second half of that game. You go into New England, and I think you lose by 3 points. I think New England's a team that's kind of righted the ship. So I feel like, in a weird way, that wasn't a, you know, kind of a soul-crushing loss for the Chiefs. I think that's one of those losses where, in the big picture, they come away feeling pretty decent about their team. Now, the defense is still a disaster for Kansas City. I think the biggest thing for me in this game, Seth, anytime I'm betting on a game involving the Bengals, like I did last week with the Steelers was one of my winners last week. A lot of it circles back to Andy Dalton. And Andy Dalton on Sunday nights, since coming into the NFL, is 0-5 straight up and 1-4 against the spread. He's just not a very good quarterback when the lights are the brightest. His playoff record is something you can point to. Hell, the Texans can speak to that. The Texans have beaten the Bengals a couple of times in prime time with not very good teams. The Monday night game back in 2015, the Christmas Eve game when they clinched the division in 2016 when Tom Savage came in. So this is a bet. It's more betting against Andy Dalton and the Bengals for me than it is betting on the Chiefs.
You know, I saw a few different articles after the Patriots-Chiefs game where people said, well, look, everybody's in love with Pat Mahomes, but everybody can now see that Tom Brady is the real deal. Which, look, I get, nobody thought he was better than Tom Brady.
Right.
But you look at that game, there's nothing to complain about with Pat Mahomes.
None.
Like, he scored at the end of the game. Could Andy Reid have done a better job keeping a little more? Like, I don't know. There was a whole lot of time left still on the clock.
It was a lot. Yeah. Like, it was a lot like the Texans game in Week 3 against the Patriots last year, right?
Yeah.
I mean, granted, Mahomes is 6 games in now. Back then, Deshaun was only on his second start. But it was one of those things where you felt like, man, Deshaun did everything he could to win that game. It's just you're on the road in New England. Your coach's cojones shrivel up a little bit, and then
you've got one of the worst defenses in the league.
Yeah, then there's that too. And Tom Brady comes back and makes plays. You know, you don't capitalize on the situations that you had. So it reminded me a little bit of that game.
So this is the big one where you and I lose our friends locally.
Yeah.
Jags -4.5 versus the Texans. I would take the Jags here as well. There's a whole lot to feel bad about with the Texans right now.
Yeah.
Not to say that there isn't a whole lot to feel bad about with the Jaguars. The one thing that I would hesitate to put money on with this game is until I find out what's going on with Leonard Fournette. Because he's not practicing today, which is Thursday.
Yep.
If Leonard Fournette plays, I know there was the theory for a while that, hey, maybe they're actually better when Leonard Fournette doesn't play.
Well, maybe Bortles had been statistically better. I mean, that was factual.
Maybe that's true with some matchups.
Yeah.
I think with this Texans offensive line, the more the Jaguars can run play action effectively, that's what's going to help out their offensive line versus I'm mixing up bad offensive lines here.
Yeah,
I get, like, honestly,
you
I
meant
have,
with
I
the
have,
Texans.
I have bad offensive line dyslexia. Look, the Jaguars are going to be helped in pass protection if they can run play action effectively. It's like when you run play action and you can just max protect and then take shots downfield, it's like feeding the village ogre a lamb instead of giving him your quarterback.
Right.
So I think that might actually be a pretty good strategy as long as Fournette's in the game.
How much do you take away from the last 2 weeks with the Texans, their ability to kind of cut the head off the snake of the Cowboys and the Bills these last 2 weeks with Ezekiel Elliott and LeSean McCoy?
I take that into account, but I just don't trust the Texans offense at all.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't. I think it's a low-scoring game.
I do, too.
That ends up being won by a touchdown by the Jaguars.
I have 20-10 as my prediction on the game. So I think you and I are kind of on the same page here.
So
But the Texans are just, like, fundamentally, we can say all we want about the matchups in this game, how we think it's going to play out. There's a big enough sample space here with this team trailing back to the end of last year. Now, granted, a lot of these games were without Deshaun Watson, but it does speak to the coaching staff's ability or inability to get the Texans to play to a level that the betting public thinks they should be playing to. The Texans are 1-9 against the spread in their last 10 games.
1-9?
Going back to last season,
Oh, my goodness.
So they're – I don't know what the one – I'm trying to think of what the one win is in the last 10 games. I don't know – that they got a push in week one against the Patriots in some places, but in most places they didn't cover because the spread wound up at 6.5. I bought it up to 7, but they didn't cover against the Titans. They didn't cover against the Giants. They lost both of those games. They covered against the Colts. That may be the lone cover in the last 10 games. They covered against the Colts in that Sunday game, because that spread was -1, +1. It hovered around pick 'em. But then the last two games, obviously, the Cowboys, I think the spread kicked off at 3.5. They won by 3, and then the Bills game was a betting disaster for some folks who backed the Texans last week.
We've got to cut this short because I've got Owen Daniels coming in.
All
here
good,
in a
buddy. Let's go 6-0 again this week.
Sean T. Pendergast on Twitter. Follow him on Twitter. He'll send out the link to his Houston Press with all his picks for his college picks. And
just went up 20 minutes ago. It's
okay,
up there
good.
Now.
Yep. At thehoustonpress.com. But follow him on Twitter, at Sean T. Pendergast. Thanks, buddy.
Salute.
So we thank Sean Pendergast once again. I feel like I'm getting a gambling education, and I'm getting enough of an education that I know I shouldn't be gambling. I've got a – I maxed out a credit card in college at a casino once, And I learned a lot of lessons about myself, including that I can't trust myself gambling. It wasn't just the casino. It was a various card games here and there where I spent more than I should ever. I basically used all of my meager life savings up to that point. So I've learned my lesson. I like watching from afar. I like watching people gamble, just like some of those people that weirdly enjoy just watching other people play video games. Although I guess that's more common now because kids are watching people stream online all the time. That's a whole nother world that I still don't quite understand. I get it. I don't like that they call it esports, but I understand the appeal to a certain degree, and I also get that I'm turning into an old who simply doesn't understand these things. Guy that's a little bit older than me but understands a lot of things is Michael Lombardi. His book, Gridiron Genius, is a very good read. I know I've mentioned a bunch of times, but you should read this book. You should get it for somebody for Christmas. Michael obviously put a lifetime of knowledge into it, and it's a lot of stories about Al Davis, Bill Parcells, Bill Belichick, on and on and on, all these visionaries and luminaries of the game and all the lessons they taught him, and he imparts onto you. Really good stuff. So let's start it off. This was my interview that I did on Mad Radio with Paul Gallant and Mike Meltzer, my co-hosts. So those are the other two voices you hear. You can follow them on Twitter at Mike Meltzer, Meltzer with an S, and at Gallant Says, both very bright young guys. Very good follows on Twitter, and just entertaining listens as well. Here we go. We'll start off with some Bill O'Brien.
I don't care what anyone says. Nobody. All I care about is the players in that locker room, the coaches upstairs, Mr. McNair, Cal McNair, their families, the support staff. I could care less about what anyone says. That's not my job. That's your job. My job is to coach the team to the best of my ability, and that's what I'm trying to do.
We care about what Michael Lombardi thinks, and that's who joins us now. Author of Gridiron Genius, a masterclass in winning championships and building dynasties in the NFL. It is an awesome book. I've read it through once, and I go back and bookmark it and highlight things all the time. Michael, should we believe any football coach when he says that he doesn't care what the media says?
You know, I do think there's probably some truth to it. I think that if you let that start to weigh into your thought process, it makes you think of things in different ways. I do think you need some people in the building, at least, to kind of give you a perspective, not saying it's from the fan base, but a perspective of what's going on, what you need to do. I think the teams that make the most progress during the seasons are the ones that are doing a really good job of self-scouting themselves during the year and fixing the problems, you know, after 4 weeks, after 8 weeks, after 12 weeks, trying to come up with the solutions as you can anticipate the problem. So, you know, on one hand, I'm not sure he's listening to the media, but he better be listening to somebody that's got a view from 35,000 feet.
You know, one of the traits that you identify in your book as a head coach needing is the ability to admit when you're wrong, the ability to self-scout and look at your own weaknesses. I feel like Bill O'Brien has that. I feel like he has a lot of the traits that make a good head coach. I'm just not convinced that he's necessarily a good offensive coordinator. What are you seeing out of that offense right now that needs to be fixed?
Well, I think their offensive line just really, it's a breakdown of every area. They just can't ever get control of the line of scrimmage. And if you ever can't get control of the line of scrimmage, you never get control of the game. And I think that's really the problem that they have. They're never able to take over the game with just their ability to – they have to find ways to create scheme runs, trick things. And so there's going to be that high and low. And I think what happened in Buffalo last week against Buffalo when they couldn't move the ball at all, I think that's a reflection of their offensive line not being able to come dominate. And it's a hard thing to do. Look, when your line's bad, you know, bad lines don't travel well. They're going into Jacksonville to play a good front. This is going to be a challenge for them. And so you try to mask the problems. You ever see I'm a big Three Stooges fan. You ever see Curly in the boat? So there's this episode with Curly's in the boat, right? And there's the Stooges are with them in the boat, and Curly swings an axe and he hits a hole in the boat, right? And so now water's coming in their little boat. So Curly has this bright idea that he's going to drill a hole over next to the hole to let the water out from the first hole. And so it just creates another problem. That's what happens when you have a bad offensive line. You're trying to you're creating stuff. You're opening up one hole, but you're opening up another hole. And that's truly what happens. And that, to me, is the best way to explain it.
I think that second hole is having Ryan Griffin, the tight end, play fullback. That's your second hole in this scenario. Yeah. I guess then the follow-up question would be, okay, Deshaun Watson, how much of it is the offensive line? How much of it is Deshaun Watson?
Well, I look. I think Deshaun Watson's it's to me, he's the stellar. He's the guy that they've got to build it around, right? And so quarterbacks are like baseball stadiums. You got to design your team around what this guy does well. I think they could benefit a little bit from being under center to take some of the heat off of it, just to give the illusion that we're going to run some play action pass, separate the defense for Deshaun. That's the defense's best friend. I mean, that's what Jared Goff's been so effective doing, is because he's under center. And he's able to do it. Look, the New Orleans Saints have scored 180 points in just five games. Drew Brees is under center a lot. The threat of a run game from under center is a powerful tool. Two backs in the backfield is a powerful tool. And I think Deshaun Watson could benefit from a little bit more of that, running that style of offense. You know, the Patriots have averaged 39 points the last 3 weeks since they've got some guys back. They're a two-back team when you break them down. They'll do two-back stuff. New Orleans is a two-back team. They'll do two-back stuff. When you watch the Rams, even though they're in 11 personnel all the time, they're essentially in two backs because they're motioning guys across. So I think you've got to find a way to help him. But I think he's the answer. He's not the problem.
Are we ever going to go back to an era where defense in the NFL takes a little bit more of a priority? And I ask this because I was looking at statistics for quarterbacks this week. Every single quarterback outside of four, we're talking 28, has a completion percentage of 60 or above, which is honestly just mind-boggling. Have we gone too far in the allowance of offense to do what they might with all these rules against defensive players?
Look, I think the ratings prove that you're not going to see defense again. 43-40, the ratings on the Sunday night game were through the roof. I mean, look, the Green Bay-San Francisco game wasn't supposed to be a good game, was a great game. I think we're in an era, and I had this conversation about 4 years ago with Bill Parcells. I asked him this question. I said, is it over with for defense in the NFL? Are we done seeing dominant defenses? And he was like, well, I'm not sure it's over, but I think you're going to have to play complementary defense. And I think that's where we are right now. We're in complementary defense status. Look, the Bears can be great all they want on defense, but the only way they're ever going to win a title is if their offense can go on the road and play well and score. That's what wins in the NFL. The Chiefs have given up 500 yards in three games this year. There's 5-1. I mean, their defense is not very good. We all witnessed it Sunday night for the first time. People that never watched the Chiefs' defense, they're bad. They're really bad. They didn't force a punt the whole day. However, they can play complementary. They're fairly good on third down. I think that's the way you're going to have to play defense in the NFL. Defense matches your offense. Your offense has got to score early, play from in front. Your defense complements it.
Michael, are you surprised the Jaguars are 3-3 with the losses they've had against Tennessee and Dallas, the way that went down on Sunday?
You know, I think we always build a perception of teams, okay? So we have this perception of Jacksonville. But when you break them down the last 22 games, they're 13-9. You know, they're 13-9 the last 22 games in all games. So it isn't like they've just dominated the NFL and they've kind of stubbed their toe. This is kind of who they are. We remember them from last year's playoff time when they went up to Pittsburgh and kicked their butt, when they almost beat New England, and we have this perception. Now, what's happened is they've only turned the ball over five times all year. Their defense is not turning the ball over. And we all know, look, we can talk about Blake Bortles all we want, okay? And the Jacksonville Jaguars can convince themselves he's their franchise. But Blake Bortles is who he is. I mean, his numbers this year are fairly in line to what his numbers are throughout his career. He's going to always be an 80% quarter QBR rating in the NFL. He's always going to have a high interception percentage. He's always going to not be very accurate down the field. This is who the Jacksonville Jaguars are. What's happened so far is they haven't turned the ball over with their defense. They haven't been able to play those kind of games. And like I said to begin this, they're 13-9 in the last 22 games. That's not a dominant team.
Speaking with Michael Lombardi. Michael, when you talk about the Jaguars and the situation they have with Blake Bortles, and yet they gave him that new contract last year. And then I think about the New York Giants and the way they seemingly are deluding themselves about the status of Eli Manning. How as an organization do you prevent that? I mean, is the desperation for a quarterback just so great that you talk yourself into a lot of compromises?
Look, I wrote it in the book. It's very clear. The hardest thing to do in any sport, whether you're in basketball, whether you're in hockey, your own players, we fall in love with players. The Giants, look, they're going to put Eli Manning's name up on the ring of honor, right? Will he go in the Hall of Fame? I don't know. I'm sure he probably will. You know, he's won two Super Bowls. His numbers aren't Hall of Fame numbers outside of that, but he's won two Super Bowls. You know, he deserves all the respect and integrity you can give him. However, he's playing horrible. He hasn't played well. They've won 32 games in the last 5 years. There's a reason for that. right? It's this joke, right? When you have a franchise quarterback, and I mean a franchise quarterback, everything else kind of falls into place. Your team can be bad. We watched Aaron Rodgers on Monday night. He's a franchise quarterback. He led his team to win. Their defense wasn't very good. They've got some problems with receivers. But franchise quarterbacks win. When franchise quarterbacks don't win, you know what that means? You don't have a franchise quarterback. You don't have one. And I think it's pretty clear at the Giants. They're just lying to themselves. They're lying to themselves. It's amazing how the media doesn't get on the Jacksonville Jaguars for not drafting Patrick Mahomes,
yes.
for not drafting Deshaun Watson. I mean, it's phenomenal. Look, I love Leonard Fournette. The Giants are catching a bunch of crap for drafting Barkley over Darnold, which they deserve. But how come Jacksonville's not catching crap for drafting Mahomes, for not drafting Mahomes over Fournette?
Right, and in last year's draft as well with Lamar Jackson, too.
But let's see Fournette behind Ereck Flowers.
Yes.
The crazy thing is, there are a lot of teams that are also lying to themselves about quarterback. I feel like Tennessee might be with Marcus Mariota. I feel like you could say the same thing about Miami and Ryan Tannehill. So what does actually inspire the change outside of injuries like we saw back in 01 with Bledsoe and Brady?
You just got to be – look, you got to sit there and say, look, if we have a franchise quarterback and we're not winning – when I was in Oakland, we had Kerry Collins, and I love Kerry Collins. He was a good player. He's not a great player. He had a 102 quarterback rating, the best in his career. We were 0-3. You know what that tells me? We're not good enough. Like, we're not good enough. Like, he can't carry us. He's playing way above his level, and we lost three games. So that means we're not any good. You got to be honest with yourself. There's indicators. You know, I write about it in the book. When you're in the NFL, you're in the veterinarian business because the patient never talks to you. You must diagnose through systems, checks, and balances. It's just like when your dog goes to the vet. He doesn't come out and say, you know, I got a bellyache today. No, the vet figures it out, right? Same thing with football teams. You got to figure it out. And the only way you can figure it out is be brutally honest with yourself. And it doesn't happen in the NFL. Look, if the Dolphins think Ryan Tannehill's the star quarterback, they're a joke. If the Denver Broncos think Case Keenum's their answer, they're lying to themselves. When John Elway drove home after Mahomes beat him, and then when he just got beat again at home by Jared Goff, he's got to say to himself, look, I'm in this fight. I have a pistol, and everybody else has got a gun. Like, everybody else has got a machine gun. I can't win. I got to figure this out.
Michael,
and unless you have that conversation, you're never going to do it.
What's the next couple of years of this John Gruden thing going to look like?
Yeah, that's a great question because John Gruden has got two hats he's wearing. He's wearing his GM hat and he's wearing his head coach hat. And I know the hats he's wearing, and I know him really well. He's not a great talent evaluator. Okay, let's just put that out there. He struggles in that area. I think if you just look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers drafts when he was down there. Now he can say he wasn't running them. Bruce Allen was running them. I mean, that's just the finger pointing. You know, who did it? Who done it? That kind of thing. So you got to look at that, and then you got to look at what he's done with this team when he's come in there. He's made it old, made it slow. I mean, read the quotes after they signed Derek Johnson. I was laughing after that. I mean, Derek Johnson's going to go on the Ring of Fame in Kansas City. He's a great player, but he was done. He was done when they signed him. You read the quotes after they signed him. You know, so I think it's a challenge. I think John's going to have to prove he's got great skills. I think what John should do is the same thing Pete Carroll did when he went to Seattle. Find somebody he's really tight with that he trusts and let that guy do it. Not that the guy's going to take any thunder away from John. Not that the guy's going to steal the spotlight from John. But the guy's going to find players. And that's going to be the key for the Raiders.
Great stuff, as always. Michael Lombardi, buy his book. I'm telling you, it's a great read. It'd be a great Christmas present for somebody in your life that loves football. Gridiron Genius, a masterclass in winning championships and building dynasties in the NFL. Michael, have a great week. We appreciate it, man.
Thanks, guys.
There's Michael Lombardi from The Athletic, from The Ringer. Check out his book as well. And on tomorrow's show, right on 9-2-8, we'll bring back the best of what Michael Lombardi had to say. I like the vet analogy. I think he's probably made that before. I don't think on our show, but probably on podcasts. But I like it. Basically, you're dealing with patients who are not going to tell you what's wrong
with
them.
Yeah. You know, the actual medical issues in the NFL are like that, too. Until guys are done with their career and they're trying to get their disability benefits.
And then
they tell
you
exactly what's wrong.
What's really going on.
Unless you're clown Seth Payne when he went to his disability. And, like, I went back into football player mode and I was like, nope, feels good. Everything's great. Everything's good. Nope. I can touch my toes. Hell yeah. Look at this.
You can touch your toes.
I know.
I've witnessed that.
What am I going to lie?
You're good at that.
Know, yeah.
Coming up next.
I'm in perfect health.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.